Are you about to launch a WordPress site? Make sure you have everything ready to go, including design, SEO, and security, with WP Engine's ultimate pre-launch checklist for WordPress sites. Download it free at wpengine.com/pre. That's wpengine.com/pre.
Intel lost 5% of productivity by giving people a $30 bonus. Now, 5% might not seem a lot, it's a lot. In the modern economy, so much of our work is under the discretion of the individual. If you think that you have 2 hours of productive hours a day, and on each of those hours you can produce 2.5 times to 3 times more than on these hours after lunch, every minute you waste of those 2 hours is a waste.
This is Love Your Work. I'm David Cadavy, and on this show, I bring you entrepreneurs and creators who have broken away from the pack. It's a huge honor to present today's guest. Dan Ariely is a researcher on the forefront of behavioral science. He specializes in understanding irrational behavior. For example, why is it that people take less candy if you give it out for free than if you charge a penny for all the candy that they want to take? Dan actively works to find ways to change behavior for the better using this knowledge. He's a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. He's also the founder of the Center for Advanced Hindsight, which helps companies improve well-being using behavioral science. Dan has also co-founded many companies, including a productivity app called Timeful. I worked with Dan on Timeful, and then Google bought the company. And so now, some of Timeful's features, such as goals, have been integrated into Google Calendar, impacting what must be hundreds of millions of people. Dan's numerous TED Talks have been viewed nearly 15 million times. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestselling books, including Predictably Irrational. He has a new book called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations, which you can buy at cadavy.net/payoff. In Dan's new book, he unlocks the secrets of motivation, whether you're motivating yourself or you're motivating others. Listen to this interview to learn why it is that bonuses can actually reduce productivity. What is it that people are really looking for from their work? How does Dan, who is a self-proclaimed bad manager, manage a big lab of really talented people? And how can you hack your own motivation using behavioral science research? It's a pleasure to bring to you Dan Ariely. When you're billing your clients, the last thing you want to waste your time and mental energy on is creating invoices. FreshBooks customers get paid an average of 5 days faster. Get your free 30-day trial at cadavy.net/freshbooks. I'm here with Dan Ariely. And Dan, you have this book coming out, Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. This sounds like it would be so relevant to so much of the research that you're known for. Can you give us kind of an introduction to what are the sort of main components of the logic that shapes our motivations?
Yeah, so I start the book with a personal story. And, you and I have known each other for a few years, so you know that I was badly injured. And because I write openly about my injury, I get lots of people with injuries writing me. Really interesting, painful, and I try to help. So people write me, and I try to call them or write them back, and so on. But I start the book with one particular example of this that I have many of, and I describe the process I went through with this one kid who was badly burned, and it was clearly a very painful process. It's been a couple of years now, but I'm still thinking about it, and I cried a lot. It was really a torturous, not torturous, but it was a very, very unpleasant, difficult.
It's a powerful
process.
Story in the beginning of the. I mean, in the beginning of Predictably Irrational, it's one of the most powerful openings of a book I've ever read. But also at the beginning of Payoff, it's also a very powerful story.
Thank you. And it was very, very strong emotion happened to me. And I basically, nevertheless, I did it. And not only that, I did it. I keep on doing the same thing. And, we have this idea of the pleasure principle, that we try to seek pleasure and avoid pain. And, of course, there's some truth to it. But here was a case where I seemingly was pursuing pain. It was as if I wanted to feel worse and I wanted to suffer more. Of course, I wasn't really interested in suffering, but I did want to help somebody else. I did care about their pain. I did care about their suffering. I wanted to help, but here was somebody I had no idea about. I didn't know, but nevertheless, I couldn't help but sacrifice some of my own well-being for their benefit. And I start with this example, which I detailed much more, but I start with this example as something that says, should we reconsider the pleasure principle? And should we basically recognize that when we seek anything at work, at life, it's actually not such a simple equation, that what truly gives us a happiness could involve things like meaning and could involve a sense of helping other people. And those are not easy things, and they're not always synonymous with pleasure. They could be different in nature, and they're not pleasurable in the simple sense of it. They could be pleasurable in the deep sense of it, in the same way that, you know, nobody climbs the Himalayas and keeps on smiling the whole way up. It's mostly, you know, frost, bites, and pain and difficulty and challenges. But there's something transcendent that comes with these challenges and so on. So I basically start the book by opening the question of what are we really after? Are we after simple joy? Are we after something else? And I try to expand the motivation equation to include all kinds of other elements. And then throughout the rest of the book, which is a short book, but throughout the rest of it, I try to elaborate on some of these other elements that are so important for the motivation equation, that are so important for what we're truly trying to strive for. And I think it's something that we need to understand in our personal life. We need to understand in our own life as working, and the people who run companies need to understand it as well as they set up the environment where people are working.
Yeah, and I think it ties into some of the work that you're really well known for, such as what's unpredictably irrational. And I remember one time we were on a call and you had this graph on your screen. I don't know if you remember this or not. You had a graph on your screen and it was like, oh, this is the prices of cars at various mileages. And it was interesting, like as soon as anything hit a zero, like as soon as a car hits 10,000 miles, then suddenly its price change drops drastically. If it hits 20,000 miles, its price drops drastically. Now, the way that a traditional economist thinks about behavior, that should be a smooth curve all along,
right?
And so we're sort of irrational in the way that we, in the way that we're motivated in some ways. And that ties into some of the findings in the book that, you know, if we're totally rational, then right, money should just be that. Okay, are you paying me this much or that much? Am I going to do it
That's
or not?
Right. That's right. So a couple of things. So that graph is a lovely graph, right? Which basically says it's not a continuous function.
It's the greatest example, I think, of you know, behavioral or irrationality in economics.
Yeah. There's another one of those, which there's a beautiful paper that's showing that the tendency of married people to go on online dating sites also is non-continuous. So when people turn 40, you know, something happens, and when people turn 50, you know,
so
yes, you know, think about yourself. As long as you're 39, you're 30. When you're 40, you know, that's a different story. Yes. You know, one more thing about just as a random anecdote about cars. You remember that terrible incident where there were defective tires? I think it was Bridgestone. A bridge something?
Yeah, it might have been in the 90s or something. Like, am I remembering that right? Okay.
Yeah.
I was
so
alive then, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So there's this terrible case about badly defected tires that, you know, caused accidents and people dying and all kinds of terrible things. And you know what they traced that accidents to? Employee disputes at the factory. So it was the lack of satisfaction at the factory that basically had an impact on the quality of people's work and therefore ended up costing people's lives, right? So you think, and sorry about the random association, just because you mentioned
cars. It
makes
sense.
And it makes sense, but it's so sad, right? Now, do you
and
think
it ties into the book as well, so I don't think it's that random.
But do you think that people did it on purpose? Of course not. Anybody at the Bridgestone factory said, oh, you know, let me just kill some customers sometimes down the line because I'm unhappy now. No, they were just less careful. They cared less about the work. And, you know, so much of what we do is discretionary effort. You know, it's one thing if you have a job, I don't know what, layering bricks, and, you know, somebody can count it and they can see how good it is and so on. But in the modern economy, so much of our work is under the discretion of the individual, right? You can either think carefully about work or not. You can either think about it on the drive home or not. You can either identify with it or not. And all of this discretionary spending of effort and energy and thought and so on are incredibly important for the workplace, but we can't measure them and we can't contract on them. So what are they? They are just an outcome of goodwill. And therefore the question really is, how do we create goodwill
with the so people critical. That we work with? This is so critical in the knowledge economy. You know, if your job is making widgets, then you just got to sit and make widgets all day. But when you have to solve problems, and sometimes you have to solve a problem, then you don't even know what the problem is, and there's all this creative thinking that has to go into it. Then, yeah, thinking about work in the shower and thinking about it all day and dreaming about it and all that, like, that ends up starting to have value, and that probably doesn't. You can't make that happen by just raising somebody's salary.
Yes, you can't. And even widgets. I mean, the example from Bridgestone is saying that even the people who do widgets, even there, there's goodwill that is hard to measure. But of course, as things become more and more at the will of the person and less measurable, goodwill is becoming more important. So if you think about, you asked me a question about kind of predictably rational and kind of the general notion of behavioral economics. There are lots of ways in which we are irrational. And, you know, in the early days, we started by looking at how people make irrational decisions, mostly about money and financial decision-making and so on. But it's always been the case that labor has been one of the most interesting topics. I mean, you have artists who are basically driven by almost like a flame inside to produce something. Most artists, as you know, live a life of poverty, but they're completely driven by a mission, right? They just want to create this art. And if you're outside of that field, it's very hard to understand, like, where is it coming from? Now, of course, that drive to create, you see in other places as well. In art, it's so clear because people are so underpaid and clearly keep on doing
it. It's clearly irrational, right?
Yes. It's a very strange. I mean, people are maximizing something that is clearly out of the standard approach of, cost-benefit analysis. Restaurant owners, startup entrepreneurs. I mean, you know, if you went ahead and did the cost-benefit analysis on lots of things that we do in modern society, many of them will say, you know, somebody is not computing things right.
I think this podcast would probably be one of them, actually.
Absolutely. Right? But not only are people are computing something very different, right? And so if you think about this podcast, if you think about starting a restaurant, if you think about starting a new business, a lot of it is about very different things than maximizing profits. But nevertheless, when we think about our ideology about why people work, we have these very simple ideologies. And, you know, nobody, like, how many people do you think you would go to when you say, what drives you? And they would say, money. I'm not interested in anything else. It's just money. But then when it comes our turn to pay people, and we say, what's driving other people? It's very to say, oh, other people just want money. And not only that, they're lazy and so on. So let me set up a particular incentive structure with bonuses and so on, so that even though they're lazy, they will behave as if they care about the work and they will work very, very hard. So, you know, as we move to the knowledge economy, I think understanding goodwill becomes more important. And how do we pay and compensate people in a way that maximizes goodwill rather than minimize it? It's also become harder and harder to track what people are really producing, right? I mean, you know, you think about somebody who's sitting there trying to solve a problem. It could take them weeks, maybe months. to solve something. What?
Or your years even, or you know, to have it, if you have a startup or something, it's like, you know, your startup, if you are in the funded world, it makes it, there's some sort of exit, or you go public or something, or you don't, and then you stop raising money and you're done.
Yep. But it could take years, and sometimes you don't see any progress being made. And then the other thing is that it's also the case that manpower is becoming more and more important, right? So if you say, what is the, if you took the P&L of most companies, or you took the budget of most companies, and you say, what is the budget, what is the part of the budget that is dedicated to salary and compensation? It's a very large part. It's the biggest part of anything in the budget, and it's only getting bigger. And it's because human capital is incredibly important. So how do we understand this incredible driver of human behavior? So, and then one last thing is that there are many things in life that have, it's kind of, if some person wins, somebody loses. So if you and I are bargaining over $100, you know, you get another dollar, I get a dollar less. Motivation is not one of those things. It's not a zero-sum game. In the motivation equation, it could be that you as my boss could benefit and I could benefit as well. Imagine how it feels like to go to a workplace where you love it. So I'm talking to you from my office at Duke. I'm in this office every day. I'm in town, including weekends. There's one day a year I don't show up to the office, which is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. But outside of that, I'm in the office every day. I'm here until late. I love what I do. I come here happy. I'm happy to be here. And, you know, the university benefits from that, right? They benefit from the fact that I'm happy here because, but everybody's benefiting. It's kind of like the perpetual energy machine, right? Where you say, can we extract more joy out of something? Yes, with motivation, we can. We can get people to be happier and their employers to be happier, and everybody benefits. So for all of those reasons, it's a great topic for a behavioral economist to study.
Yeah, and I imagine you have like a lot of research assistants and stuff as well who love to be a part of the work that you do because they feel like it makes a difference, and they're there every day along with you.
Yep. So tonight I have meetings until 10 p.m., tomorrow until a little later. Yeah, our lab is actually great. We have about 30 people ranging from undergrads to postdocs to professional staff. And it's actually, talk about motivation, it's amazing. People are so excited. We have some projects on poverty in the U.S. and poverty in Kenya and health. And, you know, the moment you get people to do something that they love, life is very, very different. So in terms of kind of my kind of, I'm not really, I'm a terrible manager. I don't manage people. I hire very good people. But then when they show up, I try to understand what they're passionate about. So my first discussion yesterday, there was a new guy who joined us, Shlomo. And rather than tell him what I need him to do, I asked him, what is he good at? Actually, I hired him without having this discussion. So he...
Surprise.
I hired him because I thought he was very good. And then he showed up. And we started having a discussion about what motivates him. What does he care about? And I asked people about their hobbies. And I asked them about what they're good at. I asked them what skills they want to build. And only once I have that sense of what they're good at, what they want to improve, where they're going through, only then I start proposing projects to them. And, you know, we also know that some people are coming, they don't exactly know, they need to explore around a little bit to figure out what they're good at. But if somebody is truly passionate about, you know, poverty, I would love to put them on a project that has to do something like this. Somebody else came and they are very passionate about nutrition, right? Let's find something about nutrition to put them on top of this. So I think that we can get people to be more motivated in any area, but I start by trying to identify what people would be particularly excited about naturally and see whether there's a good fit for this. Now, if it's not, right, if somebody's interested in, I don't know, like molecular biology and there's nothing about social science and molecular biology, I don't know how to make that fit, so then I will try to do something else. But to the extent that I can, I try to redirect people in a place where their passion comes in. And sometimes, by the way, it creates very funny research projects.
Well, I mean, it sounds like actually a really great way of managing in the knowledge economy. And it sounds like it's supported by some of your research as well. Are there any good examples there?
Yeah. So, you know, what I try to tap is I try to tap people's inherent motivation, and I also give them flexibility and autonomy, and all of those are important. So, you know, there's lots of research on these topics. I'll just repeat one of them. This was a study that we did with Intel, and in this particular study, this was a factory. And what's nice about this factory is that people produce widgets, and when people produce widgets, you can measure how many widgets they produce. So the way this factory worked was that people come for 4 days on, 4 days off, 4 days on, 4 days off. And Intel decided, the HR manager, decided the right thing to do is on the first day of the shift or the first day of the four that people are on, to give people a target of what they should aim for. And if they reach that target, to give them a bonus, about $30 of a bonus. And if they don't reach it, they get zero. So people have, they come for 4 days. Day one, there's a target and bonus. Day two, there's no target and no bonus. Day three, no target and no bonus. Day four, no target, no bonus. Then 4 days off, back to day one with a target and a bonus. So people were doing this for a while. And when I learned about this, I said, hey, can we do an experiment? Can we compare that to nothing, to a control condition? And they said, yes. So then I pushed my luck and I said, okay, maybe we can add a third condition of giving people pizza. I said, you know, let's send people pizza at home if they reach that target instead of $30. And the pizza is about $30. And my thought was it's a social reward. Plus it would get people to be heroes in the eyes of their families.
It's like you got to bring wine to your friend's house when they invite you to dinner, not 30 bucks.
That's right. And then they said yes. It turns out, though, that the HR department at Intel had a hard time delivering pizza to people's homes or even calling to. But they agreed to give people a voucher for pizza. Not the same as pizza, but still. And then we tried another condition, which was a compliment. So here's what happened. People showed up on that first day, let's call it a Monday. A quarter of the people were told nothing. A quarter of the people told, if you reach this threshold, you'll get $30. A quarter of the people were told, if you reach that threshold, you'll get a voucher for pizza. A quarter of the people were told, if you reach this threshold, you will get a kind text message from the boss saying, nice job. And then we measured their performance. Now, you know the results. But the results were that all three conditions on that Monday did better than a control condition by slightly more than 5%. Money did slightly worse. The other two did slightly better, but all of them were basically good. But the question we were most interested in is what happens the next day? The next day, there was no reward anymore, but there's still the question of goodwill. How hard did people work? And what happened was that the money condition, while it increased on a day that the bonus was there, went down dramatically below the control condition on the second day. So it went up on the first day when there was a bonus, it went below the control condition on the next day, and then slowly went back to the control condition over the next 2 days. And in total, Intel lost 5% of productivity by giving people a $30 bonus. Hmm. Now, 5% might not seem a lot, it's a lot, right? If you could get a factory to produce at 5% more, you would certainly spend a lot of money here. And what happened in fact was that Intel paid people to reduce their performance. By the way, with this knowledge, we met with the management at Intel and we described to them the results. And we said, look, you came up with a scheme that you thought would increase motivation. It not only did not increase motivation, it decreased motivation maybe we should re-examine your intuitions about about bonuses more generally. They were not interested.
Management was not interested in reducing their bonuses. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. We wanted to touch the bonuses for top management. They were not interested. They did have another very funny plan. So they had this plan. So I'll come back to the main topic. But they had this plan where they would pay college tuition, almost full college tuition, for some kids of the employees. Right? Sounds like a great deal, right? Sounds like a wonderful thing. So people have to submit an application and the grades and an essay, and they would pay for college tuition. Now, how many kids do you think they could afford it? Not that many, about 1%.
Yeah.
Right. So if they gave it to about 1%, how many people did they reject? 99%.
99%.
And you know, they described to me this process, and they were shocked that people were not loving this. And I said, what do you mean you're shocked? It's very nice that you're doing this, but you're rejecting 99% of these people's kids. Mm-hmm. It's not just rejecting them. It's worse. You're rejecting their kids. And my solution for that was to say, look, keep on doing it. Just do it randomly. Because if you do it by a selection process, you're certainly going to get people very unhappy, right? So if your goal is to create gratitude by rejecting 99% of the people's kids, you're not creating any sense of gratitude. I mean, mm-hmm. on average, you're just losing. Anyway, going back to the experiment. So I told you that the money condition decreased performance. What happened to the compliment condition? The text message from the boss, that showed an improvement on the first day and a slow decrease over time until it almost reached the level of the control condition. So the compliment was just positive. There was no, it didn't backfire. And why? This is based on what you mentioned earlier on this social norm versus market norms. That the moment you give people a bonus, you give them a payment that is very specific for a very specific thing, and it doesn't generalize to that. It doesn't create more goodwill. When you give people a compliment, you're staying in a goodwill category. You started from the goodwill category, and you stay with the goodwill category. Mm-hmm. And even when the compliment, the reward is not present, people keep on going.
It's as if there's a way that our brains are organized around these two categories, the economic realm and the sort of personal realm. This is why you don't pay your mother for Thanksgiving dinner.
That's right. So it means that there's a lot of things that we would do as favors. And the moment you do somebody a favor, you feel good about yourself. And you feel you've done your job. And there's some kind of social reciprocity from this. There's another paper by Mike Norton that I love. It's a paper where they took representative in a drug company in Belgium, pharmaceutical drugs, not illegal drugs. So these were people who were running around selling pharmaceutical drugs. And some groups, they came to them and they gave them 15 euros to spend on themselves. And they basically said, how much gratitude would those people feel toward the company and how much harder they will work? And the company basically got slightly less than 5 euros back for every 15 euros they spent, right? So I gave you 15 euros, you worked slightly harder, but very slightly harder.
It doesn't sound like a good investment. You couldn't base a business off of that kind of math, I don't think.
That's right. And other people, they gave them 15 euros to buy somebody else in the team a gift. What happened now? The return was 79 euros.
Wow.
What? Why? What happened? What happened was that reciprocity increased, right? If you gave somebody a gift, maybe they showed up to the meeting on time. Maybe they gave you a tip. Maybe they helped each other. We don't know exactly what happened, but you changed the social lubricant. I was in Palo Alto a few weeks ago, and I met with a very nice startup, and I asked them how often they stay late at night. And one of the guys said that the night before he stayed until after midnight. And I said, when you called your wife to tell her that you're not showing up until very late, what did she say? And he said that it was interesting because he stayed for a friend. He said if he called his wife and he said, I'm staying late tonight because I didn't finish my project, she would probably say, you idiot, you need to work faster and, you know, come home now. But he called her and he said, Judith is behind her project. I'm going to stay and help her out. And he was happy about this and his wife was happy about that. It's kind of strange, right? There are things
because
that
he was doing a favor, yeah.
That's right. He was doing it as a part of the social obligation. We have very different rules for those things. And this is something that it's kind of intuitive to all of us when we date, right? Nobody in the romantic partners is, you know, some people are trying to write prenuptial agreements. But outside of prenuptial agreements, very few people are trying to create explicit contracts with their spouses or their significant other or boyfriend or girlfriends about, you know, who does what exactly and how much do I pay you for every night of, you know, you take the trash or we have sex or something like that. But sometimes when we move to the business world, yes, you know, we do work for money. Relationship too. Gary Becker has this very famous paper in which he describes marriage as a business transaction where you're basically becoming, you know, you're co-producer, you have a factory, you have a business, you just call it a family. So you can look at even family this way, but of course we don't. But the same way, when we look at compensation, we shouldn't look at it as a purely transactional financial relationship because we can get much more out of it on all sides.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like when you're trying to motivate others to have some meaning, to show some appreciation, you don't want to ignore the work that they put in, and to elicit this sort of personal capital rather than capital. Any stuff that we're missing here?
Oh, there's lots of things, right? So the interesting thing about this kind of motivation equation is there's lots of things to
it's endless,
to
write. Right? There's many facets.
facets.
What about, go ahead.
So there's this beautiful example of climbing mountains. And mm-hmm. And if you think about climbing mountains, have you ever climbed anything difficult?
No, not Half Dome, right?
Okay.
That's as difficult as I got, and I got up there, and there were like 400 people up there, so it wasn't apparently wasn't that difficult.
Okay, so if you read books of people who climb the Himalayas or you know do very very difficult Everest, K2, you read their books. First of all, it's very dangerous. Lots of people die doing this, proportionally from the people who try. But you read the stories, and it sounds like one piece of misery after another. It sounds like pain and challenges and so on. And you think to yourself, given what I'm reading, the amount of pain in this thing, it's probably the case that those people are going to get up, come down, and say to themselves, this was the biggest mistake of my life.
Never doing from that now again.
On, never doing this again. From now on, it's sitting on the sofa, you know, watching some episode of, what's a good sitcom?
I think that, I actually like Peep Show a lot, but most people probably don't know that show.
I don't know it either.
It's British.
I'll check it out. But anyway, so you would think that this was just a miserable experience and people would say, huge mistake. But no, people finish it and they go up again and again. And sometimes in the process, they die. But it gives you a sense of, okay, so now let's think about mountains, for example. What is it about mountains that is so compelling? What would happen if you knew that the peak of Everest is closed? That you can go up to 20 feet away from the peak, but the peak itself is just closed for renovation or whatever it is. You would not start, right? There's something about accomplishing something for yourself and for your identity and to tell others. That's very important. What would you do if you knew you could never talk about it to anybody else? Would you be the same, motivated in the same way? You know, sad to say, but probably not.
Probably wouldn't bother, no.
Yeah. What would happen if I told you you wouldn't remember it after the fact? There's some, you know, something happens with the air and you will not remember if you've done it or not because of the thinning air. You probably wouldn't do it either. So you think about all of those examples and you say, oh, we're driven by some strange things. We're driven by trying to create a set of memories for ourselves and trying to accomplish things and trying to feel that we've competed with other people and we're doing better on some things and there's a sense of progress. I mean, there's just lots and lots of things that motivate us. And for all of us, it's important to figure out how do we do this. And, you know, you can say, oh, yes, this is something that, you know, the CEO of P&G should figure out because they're trying to motivate lots of people or, you know, the people at Google or Facebook and so on. But we all try to motivate ourselves all the time. We try to exercise. We try to eat better. We try to be better romantic partners. I mean, we're trying to do lots of things, right? And you could say, oh, let me just assume that I'll do better or make a promise that I'll do it. But that's not enough. We do need to create all kinds of motivational systems, even for ourselves in all kinds of areas.
This is exactly what I was just about to mention. It's like, what about self-motivation? I know that based on, you know, things that I've learned from reading your books and working with you, that things about self-motivation that I've started to use, like one of the tricks I do is I try to have what I call like the first hour rule. First hour of every day is like my most important project. Even if it's like a big project that I just can't stand the thought of starting, I can at least tell myself, well, I just have to work on it for an hour. And then I work on it for an hour, and then I feel good that I worked on it for an hour, that I met my goal. I don't get rejected like the 99% of those kids who are applying for that college thing. And then I feel better than I do it the next day, and then I do it, and then I start feeling good about my project, just as one example. So
yeah. And you know, this is actually for both of us, this has been an important example because we've tried to implement something like this when we worked together on Timeful. And Timeful was a startup that where we try to take the calendar. You know, one of the principles in behavioral economics is that the environment matters. And if you create an environment that facilitates good behavior will follow. And if the environment doesn't facilitate, will not. And people who use their calendars, it's quite a good tool. If you put things in people's calendars, they'll do it. And if they're not in that calendar, they will probably not do it. So, and we also found out, both from your observations, but also from the research we've done, that people take that these precious hours when we're focused and attentive and can focus and waste them on things like email and Facebook, where it's incredibly non-productive, right? If you think that you have 2 hours of productive hours a day, and on each of those hours you can produce 2.5 times to 3 times more than on these hours after lunch, every minute you waste of those 2 hours is a waste.
This is exactly the way I think of it, is that it's now or never. Yeah. I have to do this creative work right now, or it's not going to get done the rest. I don't have 24 hours in a day. I have this 1 or 2 hours, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's true. Just we don't think of it this way all the time. But of course, the data supports you, not just about you, but about other people as well. So how do you create a system for this? Now, another interesting thing is you picked something that is called a rule, right? And rules are interesting because they take decision making out of our hands, and they make it very, very easy. So think about a different rule. Think about something like Alcoholic Anonymous. They have rules that say no drinking whatsoever. Now, does it really have to be no drinking whatsoever? Why can't it be half a drink a day?
It yeah, because they're alcoholics. I mean, because if they have the half a drink, then it's going to turn into many.
But why? How? Why? But why is it that you can say no drinking whatsoever works, but half a drink will not work? And it will not work because all kinds of self-deception will happen, right? All of a sudden, people would say things like, oh, I'm taking this half a drink now from 2 weeks from now when I will not have it. Or we'll have a market for very big glasses that half a drink would look differently. And it's because people would kind of try to cheat themselves. But when you have a rule, life is very simple. You just follow this rule. This is, by the way, how religions work, right? They give us rules to follow. And as long as we follow the rule, we don't have to bother with this. There's a very interesting religious scholar, Jewish religious scholar called Eliyahu Dessler, and he basically talks about the decision point. And he says that as you become more religious and you accept more rules, less and less become part of your own decision. You basically outsource more and more of your decision. And he's claiming that you get more mental energy to deal with the things you actually want.
To deal with other decisions. It's just like Obama wearing the same suit every day or Steve Jobs wearing the same shirt every day. And
that's
those
right.
habits, they leave you with more leftover to work
yeah,
with.
And Oliver Sacks, who sadly passed away not too long ago, used to do the same thing with food. He would basically eat the same thing for a whole month. He just said, I don't want to think about this every day. Once in a while, every month, I'll decide what I want to eat, and then I'll eat the same thing for the whole month. And basically freeing our capacity to focus on other on other things. So, you know, the question of how do we organize our own environment to maximize things? How do we? So you have, if you think about this mechanism that you've created for yourself, you have a rule, but then you also feel triumphant, and you reward yourself probably later.
We're gonna take a quick break. I don't remember everything about Boy Scouts, but I do remember that they always told me to be prepared. And I didn't listen at first, but eventually I learned that they were actually right. Just when it seemed like I had something finished, I'd realize I forgot something. It's really stressful, and I just end up wasting energy fixing broken stuff. And that's why every time I record this here podcast, I have a checklist. I make sure I have a backup internet connection, I've got my mic and my notes, and I have a glass of water. And it gives me the confidence to move forward and focus entirely on making the best show that I can. WP Engine knows having a checklist helps you focus. They've put together an extremely useful ebook, WP Engine's Ultimate Pre-Launch Checklist for WordPress Sites. It's full of checklists for launching your WordPress site with confidence. They've got checklists for design, SEO, legal, security, server migration, and a bunch more. If you work with WordPress sites at all, you gotta download WP Engine's Ultimate Pre-Launch Checklist for WordPress Sites free at wpengine.com/pre. That's wpengine.com/PRE.
But I'm also interested in something else about your own approach. Do you have any ritualistic aspects to this? Do you, for example, when you sit down, do you make a cup of coffee, or do you do other things that are kind of indicating the beginning of the process?
Yeah, I'll get into some specifics here. In that, one, I don't drink coffee at all, but I specifically like morning times for creative work because, as discussed in a previous podcast episode with neuroscientist John Cunios, that's a time when I'm a little groggy, and so I'm actually going to be doing better creative thinking. And so it's first thing in the morning. Sometimes I'll meditate beforehand, or I'll have a dream journal. There is a shelf that I have that I can set up to work standing up. And so that first hour, part of the rule is I have to work standing up. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely the first possible thing that I can do after, you know, maybe taking some supplements or drinking a little glass of water or something. As far as rituals, you mean like little triggers that give me a sense of reward for doing the thing that I'm doing?
Either reward or sense of meaning, or connecting it to other things that you're doing, or connecting it to a big principle. So you know, we often think about habits, and habits are things that we do without thinking much about them. Mm-hmm. But rituals are different. Rituals are not about not thinking about something. Rituals are actually about giving something extra thought and attention, but feeling that it's also meaningful to a higher degree than a particular instant. So think about two kind of people. Think about person A, who thinks about recycling, and every day they make the calculation. How useful is recycling? How cold is it outside? How much is the city hall saving for my recycling? Person B says, good people recycle. And that's it. Now the first person has to make the computation every day. For the second person, it's a part of a bigger principle. And by being a part of a bigger principle, a single violation is much more costly because they violated what they think mm-hmm. being a good person means. And rituals allow us to connect ourselves to those things, right? So there's a ritual of saying things like I'm taking care of myself, or I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm doing the kind of work.
A lot of that thinking happens beforehand when I'm deciding what is, you know, the first thing I'm going to work on, is that it's always going to be something to me that I feel like this is the most important thing I could be doing with this precious energy. And that's what I'm going to do every morning for a set amount of time. So, actually, this makes me think about a question that I would love to ask you. I ask all my guests whether they make their bed or not. And I usually have some sort of a speed round where I ask that. But with the time that we have, I want to ask you about this making bed ritual. Because, first of all, do you make your bed?
I don't. Okay, I've seen some of the research that's saying how good it is.
Oh, tell me. Well, wait. Hold on a second. Tell me about this research, and then I'll tell you what I've learned in my own independent research, and then theories.
So I did see something a while ago. I don't remember what journal it was, that basically said that it's a good way to start the day, and separate the night from the day. And today, by the way, I read an early version of a manuscript, so it's not out yet. This is a fascinating thing. These are prison guards who were asked to wash their hands when they left prison before they went home. And they showed that they had a more calm and happy demeanor when they got home after washing their hands.
Hmm. It was Lady Macbeth.
Yeah, it was the symbol of kind of dropping the difficult complexities of life in prison, which is, you know, awful for everybody. It's terribly awful for the prisoners, but it's also not a picnic for the guards. And it was a symbolic leaving it behind and starting something different, kind of transitioning. And I think that doing your bed is the same thing. It's kind of basically helps the transition from night to the day. Right. And I do something on the other side of it, but I'll tell you about it later. But tell me, what do you do?
Okay, well, all right. So first of all, I always hated the idea of making my bed, and I always protested to my mother because the standard logic is you're just going to get into it later and you're going to mess it up, which ties into some of the things I've read in this new book, but also. And you just hear it said over and over again, oh, make your bed to be successful. But, you know, I like to think the people that have been on this podcast are pretty successful. The majority of them, by far, do not make their beds. Wow. So there's that element. Then there's that you're going to just mess it up. But there's also, it makes me wonder about the fact that willpower is this finite resource. And maybe it depends on how much willpower it takes for you to get yourself to make your bed. Like, if it takes you a lot of willpower to get yourself to make your bed, would that possibly make it more difficult for you to have self-control throughout the day?
Yeah. So I think the question is, are you going to make making your bed a habit, a ritual, a rule? In which case, once it becomes a rule or a ritual, it will not take willpower. Mm-hmm. Right. Willpower takes only things that you question whether you should do them or not.
If you're making the decision in the morning, contemplating whether I should make my bed or not, do I have time, etc., versus this is just something I do.
That's right. So I think you can change it. By the way, I also last year I traveled 253 days, I think. Mm-hmm. So, wow. I don't make my bed in the hotel room.
Somebody's going to come and make it in a little bit. So
that's right. That's a strange thing, right? If somebody that will be some obsessive personality too, if you start staying in the hotel and make your bed.
Yeah.
When you're staying in the hotel.
But it's nice when the bed is made, though, isn't it? Don't you walk in and you like feel, oh, this is good that it's made. I don't necessarily have to make it myself, but.
Absolutely. You know, but the other thing on the other side of falling asleep, you know, when Timeful was still around, we started working on bedtime procrastination. And bedtime procrastination is different than regular procrastination, right? Regular procrastination is say, oh, I know I have to do this project, but there's, you know, movie I want to see, or basketball, or meeting some friends, or beer, or something else. Bedtime procrastination is that you're in bed, and you know you have to sleep, and you know you have work tomorrow, and you know that you should get a good night rest, and you know we have to sleep for 7 or 8 or whatever hours you think that you need to sleep. But you say, but I'm not tired yet. So instead of just closing my eyes now and waiting to fall asleep, let me answer 4 more emails. Mm. And you know, 2 hours later, you're basically druggy, but still trying to, you know, to answer email, and you don't sleep. And then, of course, the next day you pay the price and you say, why didn't I go to sleep earlier? So bedtime procrastination is different because it's not that we're postponing work for pleasure. We're actually postponing sleep for work. So it's not that you say, I just need to watch this one more episode on YouTube or Netflix. So the one thing that I do at night, which actually the research support, is I don't do anything in bed but read. But sleep. So I don't do anything in bed but sleep. If I want to do something else, I do it out of bed. Mm-hmm. So I usually try to read before falling asleep, and I read on a chair rather than in bed. And I'm conditioning my body to know that when I'm in bed, I'm serious. This means sleep time. It's not something else. And especially because I'm in so many time zones, I'm moving between time zones all the time, this conditioning is incredibly helpful, right? Where you basically indicate to the body, bed is for sleep. When I come here and my head is on the pillow, that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, this is why I don't allow like my mobile device in my bedroom, and I'll even have like my iPad. There's no messaging allowed on my iPad. So it's for reading, it's for different activities. I want to be focused and deep when I'm touching that iPad. Same thing with bed. If I'm in my bed, I want to be sleeping.
Yeah. You know, this separation is another kind of interesting thing. So I used to have 2 computers in my office, and one was just for work, and the other one was work plus other things, and it was interesting because it made the switch from work to non-work very clear, right? Right now, if you have one computer and you do everything on the computer, you can start working. You click on the link, and then you find yourself doing something that you did not plan on doing. But if you have 2 computers, this separation, basically moving up from one desk to another, makes it very clear that you've switched modes. And I think too often, we just get this mode switching without really paying attention to the fact that we've just switched.
And this is one of those cognitive errors that is at work when that person says, oh, I'm just going to answer a couple of emails before I go to bed. Is that all minutes are created equal. You have put yourself in a different mind state that is completely at odds with going to sleep. One thing that I've found that, you know, just anecdotally, is that I try to avoid things before bed that involve me thinking about anybody that isn't really close to me, right? So Facebook, email, you know, you're looking at people who you never talk to, or you're reading articles. For me, that kind of takes my mind out into this place that makes it difficult for me to fall asleep. That's why reading a book or just relaxing and having some kind of wind down, I find I wake up way more refreshed when I work that way.
Yeah. By the way, the sleep is one of those areas that we really have to do something about it. We're terrible at sleep, and actually, it's fascinating. You know, I've been asking in the last few months. I've been asking people, what do they know about sleep? So, you know, most people. David, how old are you?
37.
37. So, you know, you've been sleeping for quite a few years.
I've got lots of experience, and I've gotten better at it.
You have. And you know, I ask people, what do you actually know? Not what works for you, what doesn't work for you. And it's kind of interesting that almost nobody knows anything about sleep. So first of all, people don't read about sleep, right? So that's kind of okay. But people also don't experiment with it. You know, some people who kind of use the quantified self can tell me how many hours they sleep and how much REM sleep they have and so on. But when I asked them, like, what causes you to sleep better? What causes you to sleep worse? We just don't naturally experiment. Like, you would think that you would say, okay, for the next 3 months, let me stop drinking coffee after 4 p.m. And for the next 3 months, let me not exercise in the evening, but exercise in the morning. And you would think that people would try different things and over time figure out what helps them sleep better or not. But people, none of us do. And it's kind of, it's a really wonderful example of something that we do every day. A third of our lives. And we're just terrible. We just don't understand how it works. And I really want to do something that would help people experiment with their own sleep pattern. And it's something that you need patience, because days are also different from each other. There's natural variability that happens. So it's not as if you could do something one day and said, oh,
There's seasons to it for me. I mean, like, I sleep differently in the fall than I do in the winter. It seems to go in like a cyclical thing that I've started to notice. There's a really great, not to like recreate it, but there's a really great Freakonomics series about sleep where they actually talk about people who, you maybe have read this study, where there are people who were in the same time zone, but one was in a part of the time zone where they would have to wake up earlier, they would get less sleep, and then another part they would get more sleep, and the ones who got more sleep earned more money, which was offset by the cost of living. But
There's another recent paper that came out that showed that sleeping in the same bed with somebody else, in that experiment, they were not always their spouse. They actually varied.
Just a random person.
I mean, not right. I mean, they were volunteers and so on. But that helps as well, right? And they think it's the synchronicity of the breathing.
Wow, I would have guessed the opposite. Though it makes sense evolutionarily that, you know, we spent our whole history sleeping in packs to protect each other, right?
Yeah. And it also makes sense that something about the... You will get a signal that things are calm where other people are asleep around.
If they're sleeping, it must be safe, and so it's okay for you to sleep, and so your nervous system can chill out. Wow.
Yeah, lots to study on that.
Yeah. Gosh, speaking of like smooth transitions to things, we're like totally rolling right here, but we're pretty much out of time. So are there any, based upon our conversation today, is there like a summary for you that you'd like to share with our listeners?
So, you know, we talked about all kinds of things, but I would say two things. The first one is that, kind of as a social scientist, you know, I think that there's lots of mysteries in the universe. There's out of space, there's molecular biology, but, you know, the mystery of our own lives is really quite amazing. It's here and we see it a lot, so we don't always think about how mysterious it is. But when you stop and think about it and you say, how does compensation work? What is motivation? Why can't we sleep? How do we manage our environment? What should we do differently? It's really an amazing thing about how little we understand about our own lives. And then the second thing is the power of experimentation. You know, people have intuition. Sometimes we have strong intuitions, and I think that we've shown over and over and over that intuition doesn't always work, that often we have intuition that is just wrong. And when intuition is wrong, the question is, what kind of data can we collect to figure out what actually works better? And my hope is that people in general, all of us, would become more interested in kind of the human condition, what's working, what's not working, and will be more data-oriented. How do we do experiments to try out what we could do differently, whether it's at work or at home, about sleep, about compensation, almost any topic deserves some more serious investigation.
Yeah, this is something that we didn't get a chance to talk about, but just with all the technology that we have available and all this behavioral science knowledge that we have available, we are on the cusp of what I think is like a behavioral revolution, that we can really change behavior for the better with this knowledge, if we take the time and mental resources to actually examine these things. So something for people to think about.
Hallelujah to that.
And is there anywhere that you'd like for people to come to find more of you?
So my blog is danarielly.com, danarielly.com. www.ipsos.com, and there's information there. There's a movie on Netflix that I co-produced about it's my great. Research on this. Oh, thank you. On dishonesty, and then this new book, Payoff, will be out in the middle of November.
Great. Thanks so much, Dan Ariely. It has been an honor having you.
As always, wonderful to talk to you.
Your designer has been lying to you. Design doesn't have to be a mystery. You can do it. Get $100 off any pay upfront package of my flagship visual design course, D4H Video. Just go to cadavy.net/video and use the code LOVEIT on any pay upfront package. I hope you enjoyed that talk with Dan Ariely as much as I did. Remember to buy his book Payoff at cadavy.net/payoff. He mentioned Timeful a few times. Dan and I worked together on Timeful, and it was eventually bought by Google. Now some of those Timeful features are in Google Calendar. And if you want to hear more about that experience and what I learned about my own productivity in the process, check out episode 40 of Love Your Work. If you appreciate all the work that goes into making this show, there are a few ways you can help support it. One is to subscribe on iTunes or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Just hit the subscribe button. And another is to rate the show. On iTunes, that's just a matter of clicking on the star rating. Most people give it 5 stars because, after all, you're listening to the podcast a lot, so you probably like it. The final way is to use my affiliate link when shopping on Amazon. Just go to cadavy.net/Amazon anytime you shop on Amazon, and that will magically donate a portion of your purchase toward making Love Your Work. Heck, put it in your bookmarks so you have it handy. And recently, somebody bought thousands of dollars of camera equipment using that link. And that was a big help. They were probably making a corporate purchase, so keep that in mind if you make any corporate purchases. But no matter what the size of your purchase, it doesn't cost you anything. And if you like books, sign up for my reading recommendations emails. Just go to cadavy.net/reading, sign up, and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for the show is More Streets, performed by Spiderflower. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.